data and seeing if there was an excess in gamma rays that could be consistent with dark matter. And essentially, of the results that have come out, find an excess, and they find it to be consistent with dark matter, but it also could be consistent with other possible explanation, like an unresolved population of sources. Most of these analyses, actually all of them except for one, which is shown here, are using the same background model for the diffuse emission. So they use basically one model. They don't have any systematic uncertainties to take into account all these different things that we don't know about how about cosmic rays. And essentially, they find the results that are very consistent with each other, which is, given the way the analyses are performed, is not very surprising. So one of the analyses stands out, and I didn't discuss it this morning, was this analysis, and this plot shows the spectrum of the axis that they derived. So the data are shown by the black points, and these yellow bands represent the systematic uncertainties on the background model. And the way they derived those systematic uncertainties is to go back to modeling of the gamma ray diffuse emission through a grid of model that includes uncertainties on the generation, acceleration, and propagation of cosmic rays. So they basically looked at that big grid where you can make different assumptions on some of these parameters. They pick a set of models, and that gives them this yellow band. A possible issue by doing that kind of work is that, as I've shown you before, those models give you an excess in a very broad region around the direction of the galactic plane, which is also correlated with the plane. So the possibility, if you do things like that, is that you might be picking up uncertainties in the diffuse emission, because those models by themselves are really not describing the data well in a region that is really larger than your signal region. So they have already clear shortcomings. So what I'm going to talk now about now, it is the last thing that I'm going to, the last analysis that I'm going to cover that on the Galactic Center. And this is the analysis that has been done by the Fermilat collaboration. In this analysis, we focus on a 15 by 15 degree region around the galaxy center, which is a little smaller than what other people have used. And at the galactic center, that spans a region of roughly 1 kiloparsec. So these are the data. What we want to do with this analysis, trying to extract the contribution that comes from this innermost kiloparsecs around the galactic center. Most of the work that we do is in trying to build a specialized model to analyze this specific part of the sky. So we are not really interested in getting models that perfectly describe the entire sky, but we want to have a good, or as I said, a specialized model for this specific part of the galaxy. So we know that one of the things that we don't know very well is how the sources of cosmic rays are distributed. And that is one of the big uncertainties when you want to model the diffuse emission coming from the center of the galaxy. As I said this morning, tracing supernova remnants is not very easy. We don't see very many of these objects. And there is an observation bias when you see them, because you're more likely to see the ones that are closer to you, which may not be representative of a galactic population. So then we use proxies for the distribution of supernova remnants by looking at the life of a star and looking at an earlier stage of a supernova, which is OB stars, or a later stage, which is pulsars. And this is how these distributions are. This is the density of the cosmic ray sources as a function of the galactocentric radius. This is in 2D, and obviously in the models, but this distribution have cylindrical symmetry. We have other possibilities that we can use for the cosmic ray distribution, but this is the one that spans the broader range in the radial extension of the supernova remnant. The pulsars are distributed all the way to the galactic centers, while if you model your supernova remnants following the distribution of obisars, there is really that kind of assumptions have very few sources towards the galactic center. So these are basically our systematic uncertainties on the distribution of point sources. Then what we really want, what we do, the core of the analysis is to tune the initial models that we use to perform the analysis to outside of our region of interest. So let me explain more in detail what that means. As I said, we want to extract, so we are looking at the data inside these two lines in a 15 by 15 degree region, and we want to extract the contribution that is coming from roughly 1 kiloparsec. So what we want to do is to extract this contribution is to subtract from the entire line of sight the emission from the foreground and the background. And say if I, the way we do that, so we need to model the emission that comes from cosmic rays interacts with the gas and the radiation field. And in general, this is done by breaking the gas into galactocentric radii or annuli. And I mentioned some of that this morning. And you do that both for the gas and the interstellar radiation fields. So if I want to determine the contribution that comes from the gas and the interstellar radiation fields when the cosmic rays interacts with them, say for ring four, and I want to see what the contribution from ring four is in the line of sight towards the galactic center, I look at region outside of my signal region to determine that contribution. And then once I tune the contribution from ring four to outside my signal region, I use the contribution and rescale it to what it would be for along the line of sight. The way we do that, we do it both in two ways. In one tuning process, we only allow the normalization of the intensities of these rings to vary, while we keep the spectrum consistent with the prediction that comes from a large scale model. So we are only allowing for a larger or smaller density of cosmic rays or a larger or smaller density of the interstellar radiation fields and the gas. That is within each ring. Obviously, since each ring is fitted independently, we are also allowing for some variations in the morphology. So that is one tuning procedure, but just allowing the intensity of these rings to vary. And we do that both for pulsars, cosmic ray source distribution, and the obistars, cosmic ray source distribution. Then we have another tuning procedure that goes in parallel. And in this other tuning procedure, we allow both the intensity of the rings to vary, but also the spectrum, in particular from the pi zero production in each of the ring. And what that translates to is that would take into account for the variation of the spectrum of the cosmic rays as a function of the galactocentric distance. And in fact, when we look at the results, we see that the spectrum that we actually fit to the data is indicating that as we move closer to the center of the galaxy, that spectrum is becoming harder than the prediction that you get when you assume that the spectrum of the cosmic ray measured locally is the same everywhere in the galaxy. So there appears to be some variation as a function of the radial distance. Then the tuning procedure, I'm going to go quickly through that since I'm tuning these rings one at a time. And I want to fit them independently from the other rings. I'm looking for each of the rings. I'm looking in regions of the skies where they contribute the most. So, ring six Ring 5 is the local ring. It's the ring that contains the solar system, and it's very extended in the sky. And ring 6 is the outer ring that basically contains all the emission from the sun all the way to the outskirts of the galaxy. So we look at the parts that are close to the anti-centers to tune this contribution, where there is little contribution from the disk of the galaxy. So then as we tune the contribution for rings that are closer and closer to the galactic center, we look at regions of the sky that are closer and closer to the galactic center. Okay, so this is all this work, as I said, is what we do to determine the background in the line of sight. From this tuning procedure, we leave out the signal region, as I said, but we also leave out regions that contain structures that are not modeled, that we haven't included in our model. For instance, I mentioned the Fermi bubbles this morning, these very extended structures in gamma rays. We don't put them in the model because we don't really know what their emission is close to the galactic center. And if they're there, they will show up as an excess. But we don't want to bias the fit of the contribution from these rings by including them, because also the uncertainties on those on the spectrum of the intensity of the Fermi bubbles can be large. Out of this tuning procedure, now we have four different estimates of the foreground and background model. Two, because we use two different assumptions of the cosmic ray source distribution, and you multiply that by two, because each of these models is tuned either by just tuning the intensity of the rings or tuning the intensity and the index of the spectrum, but only for the pi zero spectrum and not of the inverse Compton spectrum. So that allows us to determine the line of sight contribution. Then the other thing that we need to determine is the point sources in this 15 by 15 degree region. And the way we do that, we don't use any existing catalog. Say Fermi has a point source catalog, but those point sources are determined with a different background model. And that background model is really only used to detect point sources. So we need to make our own catalog of the point sources. And this is a very lengthy procedure. So when we want to determine the contribution from this 1 kiloparsec region around the galactic center, we take all the data that comes from the 15 by 15 degree region. We model it as a contribution from the foreground and that background, but we leave that fixed in the fit for each of the four estimate or the four determination of the foreground and background. And then we fit the data by leaving free to vary the intensity of the cosmic rays or the diffuse cosmic rays interacting in the gas and the interstellar radiation fields inside, just inside within the innermost annulus. And we fit the sources at the same time as this emission. What comes out of that? Okay, these are just some maps of the 15 by 15 degree region. Each pixel is showing a flux, and this is within this region the contribution for the foreground and background. This is inverse Compton. This is pi zero production from atomic hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, and this contribution includes ionized hydrogen and bremsstrahlung. And this is the contribution from these processes coming from the innermost annulus. So what do we get out of all of that procedure, out of that procedure? So what these two plots show, these are just the count spectra for two of these foreground and background models. This is for the pulsar point source distribution, and this is for the OBSTAR point source distribution when we are only tuning the intensity of the rings. So we find that the agreement between the data and the model, this panel at the bottom showed the fractional residual as a function of the energy, is at the level of 5 to 10% This is averaged over the ROI up to about 10 GEV or so. And so we have a mild axis here, and then the axis continues to rise as a function of the energy. And that looks the same with regardless of the assumption on the cosmic ray point source. So there is an excess in the few GeV energy range, and there is a deficit below 2 GeV or so, and the excess continues. And this is a statistically significant excess in both cases. We can get a little bit better agreement when we are also tuning the spectrum of the diffuse emission coming from pi zero production outside of the ROI. And so we get this is the for pulsar for the tuned index model for the pulsar cosmic point cosmic ray source distribution, and this is for OB stars. And you can see there is still a little bit of an excess in the few GeV energy range, but now an excess at high energy has turned mostly into a deficit on the, in those at those energies. So one other interesting result, and I'm going to talk about this residual emission in the next few slides. What an interesting result that we find is that when we, so we are determining the contribution from inverse Compton emission from this innermost kiloparsecs, and we find that it's a lot larger than what comes out from a standard diffusion model. And that might be indicating that either the density of the cosmic rays in this inner kiloparsecs is larger than we think it is, or that the interstellar radiation fields are more intense than we thought they were, right? The inverse Compton is a combination of the intensity of the fields and the density of the radiation fields, and we cannot really discriminate between those two possibilities. If you, since inverse Compton comes from electrons, you can actually get some information on the density of electrons if you look at other wavelength coming from synchrotron emission in magnetic fields from a population of cosmic rays near the galactic center. But then you have their uncertainties of what the actual magnetic field on the galaxy is at the center of the galaxy. So you have an additional knob there that you can play with. What comes out of then going back to the residual emission? So these now are the spatial residual. So it's data minus model for the 15 by 15 degree region for the pulsar tuned intensity and the pulsar tuned index. This is the one that gave, at least if you look at the residual as a function of the energy, the better agreement. And these are the residuals are broken into three different energy ranges, 1 to 2 GeV, 2 to 10, and 10 to 100 GeV. Below 2 GeV is when we saw a deficit in the data where the model was over-predicting the data, and we see that over-prediction seems to be correlated with the galactic plane, and so that might mean there is still something that in the diffuse emission that we're not modeling very well. In the 2 to 10 GeV energy range, when there is a bit of an excess that is left, it looks like that excess emission is concentrated towards the galactic center, and that higher energies, I mean, you start running out of statistics, and in, depending on the way you're tuning your model, you might have an excess that may be correlated with the plane or a deficit. So even though you can get better agreement by really tuning your model in the best way that we could do by using this procedure, the data and the model agreement are not very good. And even if you don't have a striking excess, the fact is you still see a deficit in some of the energies that we have considered. It might be pointing to the fact that maybe, yes, there is an additional component in your model, but in the fit, basically when the fit is fitting the data, it's making some of the background component too bright to compensate for it. So what we did after that is to test the possibility that there is in fact an additional component in the data, and we have chosen a number of possibilities for the morphologies that this additional contribution might have. we have chosen a number of just basically geometrical templates, like Gaussians with different width, and center at the galactic center. That's where it seems that the axis seems to be concentrated around, and these templates don't perform very well. Then we have used a morphology for dark matter annihilation and decay. And we also have used a morphology that should be tracing an unresolved population of pulsars. And the way we have modeled the unresolved population of pulsars, and the way these objects are distributed is really something that we don't know very well. And we have modeled them by just using the molecular gas distribution and smearing it out to take into account for the fact that pulsars receive kicks and they can travel large distances from the place where they were produced, but it really sort of follows the morphology of the plane. Out of all of these morphologies, a dark matter annihilation morphology does significantly better than the rest of them that I have mentioned. All of this morphology are going to give you a significant detection for that component, but you get the largest improvement by far when you use a dark matter annihilation morphology. And so what happens when you add this component to the fit is that I said before that the inverse Compton contribution that we find without adding the additional component when just fitting the data with the background model, the inverse Compton component is very bright to what we expected it to be. But then once you add this additional component, the inverse Compton contribution goes down, and this new component that you have added to your model starts picking up roughly half of those events that were going into inverse Compton. So this is how we have modeled the morphologies for this additional component. And the spectrum, for the spectrum, we have considered two different assumptions. We have modeled it in one case as a power law with exponential cutoff. And we have chosen this because it's representative of a spectrum of pulsars, or a population of pulsars, but also a power law with exponential cutoff is a good spectral model to fit a BB bar spectrum. So it's also a good spectrum to use to model dark matter annihilation final state. So something that is this bumpy, like the green curve that you may barely see, is consistent. It's very close to what a BB bar spectrum would look like. And these harder spectra that you find, these are the spectra that we get for the additional component when you use an NFW annihilation template in your model. So these are the spectra that we are extracting if we assume that the axis has the morphology of dark matter annihilation. And the spectrum varies quite a bit. The spectrum you obtain for this component varies quite a bit depending on the on the background. The results that I've shown before are very consistent with this green curve, which, as I said, has a spectrum that's very similar with a BB bar spectrum for a mass roughly around 5 GeV. These spectra that have a harder cutoff are more consistent with the harder spectrum in gamma rays that you get if you have annihilation, so say into W bosons. So this is, but then if you look at the fractional residual as a function of the energy, you can get a good agreement, in particular for the pulsars index tuned model, up to maybe 30 GeV or so. This model continues to do fairly well, while there is a discrepancy between the data and the model for all of the other foreground background models that we have considered. So this might mean a couple of things. Maybe we were really messing up the modeling of the diffuse emission, and the pulsar tuned index model is the one that actually models it best. And so we have pretty good agreement in that case. And this axis that we see here, it's really due to emission, to just diffuse emission that we haven't, that we have poorly modeled in those cases. And this result is derived by giving more freedom to the spectrum of this additional component. In particular, the fit is performed in energy bands where the content in energy bands is varied independently. And you see that if you give this additional flexibility to the spectrum, it starts picking out more events at high energies and you get a good agreement between the data and the model. Yes.
So to model the background, you're looking outside of your field of view?
Yes.
Do you think, what if the Milky Way was like a barred spiral? So, and we're looking down the bar?
Yes.
Will we be missing just all of the dust in the middle?
Yes, it could be actually, right. That is, right. So that is one of the big problems that these models have. All of them is that the structure of the galaxy, like the ball, the stellar bulge or the spiral arms, they are not modeled. So the distribution of cosmic resources is it's just cylindrically symmetric. And all those structures are not taken into account at all, and they will definitely have some effect, yes. And that's one of the big shortcomings that we have to address. So the other thing is that it's, even if this additional component picks, if you give this flexibility to the spectrum, it starts picking out these events at high energy, it's really hard to determine what the morphology of this event is like. Since these high energy events are ending up in the dark matter, in the dark matter, are assigned in the dark, to the dark matter template by the fit, it means that they are more consistent with that morphology rather than, say, the gas morphology or the inverse Compton. But again, the point here is that this, I don't, it shouldn't be taken to face value that if I put an NFW morphology or a dark matter annihilation morphology and you fit the spectrum in this way, these events actually belong to that template or to that morphology. So you're basically, you're running out of statistics out here, and it's hard to determine what the morphology of those events is. And this is just the same plot as before, but instead of being plotted as counts, is the flux multiplied by E squared. This now are the spatial residuals. These are the ones that I've shown you before for the pulsar-tuned index background determination. And this is what the residuals look like if you add this additional dark matter component to the fit. And if you stare at these long enough, you can see that the agreement certainly improves when you add this additional component. Obviously, right, these three plots are looking a lot more like noise, which is what you'd expect to see if data and model perfectly agree, than what we had before. So there are still a number of issues. There are still some discrepancies, significant discrepancies between data and model. So even this doesn't really give you a perfect description of the data. And if you look at this plot, and some people have brought up these issues, it looks like the axis, even though it looks like it's maybe concentrated toward the galactic center, it's a little bit lopsided. It looks like it's brighter here on the right of the galactic center than it is to the left of the galactic center. That is something that it's a little bit tricky to interpret, because we know that the molecular gas emission, if you look at the gamma ray emission coming from molecular gas, if you actually look at the maps, the molecular gas is very bright exactly in this region. And the reason is that there is, in fact, a high concentration of gas, but the issue I was bringing up this morning of not knowing exactly where to place the gas, or in the case of molecular gas, there's the additional complication that you don't trace molecular gas directly, but you trace it through other molecules that are in the molecular gas clouds. Then you'll need to have a conversion factor for that particular molecule to molecular hydrogen, and there are uncertainties there. So what could be happening here is that there are gas clouds in this region. We have over-predicted their emission, and so they are over-subtracting the data in that region, and maybe an axis that would have been symmetric with respect to the galactic center now is going to look lopsided, not because the actual axis is lopsided, but just because of your poor modeling of that background on one side. So after all of this, it's very hard to conclude what's going on in the galactic center. There is some evidence that there is an excess, and the morphology study are pointing you in one direction, but we know that we have still a big issue in modeling the background. And some of the issues are the gas distribution that I have mentioned, the distribution and dense intensity of the interstellar radiation fields, and this assumption of cylindrical symmetry in the distribution of cosmic resources in the galaxy. And so those are all things that are crucial to understand better, to determine really whether or not there is an excess, and if this excess persists, what it looks like. Because what if doing all these studies doesn't remove the excess, but it makes it look different, that's obviously going to affect the interpretation. Okay, so that's mostly what I had. That's all I had to say about the galactic center. So there are still issues, and I'm not going to read through this. But one thing that would be really, really good would be to have a better instruments especially if that instrument, at least this is my opinion, could provide better angular resolution, we could resolve the gamma ray emission better and therefore know with more accuracy where that emission is actually coming from, will really help you disentangle the emission that we observe. Yes.
So when you do this for the NFW, like profile peak spectral cutoff, mm-hmm. is the normalization similar to what you would need to match on, say, what the Hooper paper was?
It's very, very close to it. Yes, it actually does match it pretty well. Yes. So this is the emission that comes from this image spans half a degree horizontally, and it's the image of the galactic center region. This is actually Sagittarius A stars, which is very bright in X-rays. So the different colors show near infrared, and X-ray that is shown in blue and violet. So this is half a degree across, and so you see with beautiful details a lot of structures in this region of the sky. And so this is the 15 by 15 degree region in gamma ray, and then you can see how poor the angular resolution of gamma rays is compared to all those wavelengths. And where you see in gamma rays sort of a blob, there is a lot of structure there, and a lot of the structure could be emitting gamma rays, but the gamma ray data really doesn't give you enough resolution to pick it out or to actually distinguish it for what is around. And as I said, if you could do that better, you could understand things a lot better than we do today. Okay, so that was gamma rays from the galactic center region with Fermi. Let's still look at the galactic center, but move to higher energy. So this is an image of the galactic center region from Hess. And this image spans 2 degrees, and this is the emission that Hess observes. So there is a bright source at the center that is positionally, essentially it's very, very well overlapped with the Sagittarius A star, the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And then there is some extended emission, which is traced very well by the radio emission from that is tracing molecular gas. So what's going on there is what Hess is seeing is certainly point sources there and some extended emission coming from cosmic rays that are accelerated and are striking the gas. So by just looking at the image, it looks like what you are observing is consistent with what you expect to be there, meaning that there is no excess that appears there that could be coming from dark matter. But in any case, there are still some uncertainties in modeling this emission, and to avoid, to get around that complication, when they search for a signal of dark matter coming from these regions, avoid the region along the galactic plane where they are detecting events altogether, and they look outside of that region to empty region of the sky where they're not detecting any gamma rays. And so by the non-observation of gamma rays, they are able to set conservative constraints on the annihilation cross-section for dark matter. So in particular, these are the constraints that they get, again, by the non-observation of gamma rays in these regions. So the constraints are determined by assuming, I believe these are assumed as annihilation into BB bar, and the constraints are as a function of the annihilation cross-section and the mass of the dark matter particle. These are the best constraints that they get with different assumption on the profile of the dark matter distribution. This is for a cusp Einasto profile that's very slightly compared to an NFW profile. And this is the thermal, so the annihilation cross section that you expect for a vanilla thermal relic. So Hess is not quite close to really where we want to be sensitive to. So the galactic center is complicated because of the background. To get around the complications that come from modeling the background, you can look or search for dark matter substructures. And so dark matter, called dark matter, as I've said many times, predicts a lot of substructures. And the largest or most massive of this substructure have been observed optically. And these are the dwarf spheroidal galaxies that I have already discussed a little bit yesterday. So these are very good target for indirect dark matter detection because they are expected to be free from gamma ray sources. So these are galaxies that have evolved over a long time. They had some star formation period, but that has been over for a long time. So they are not expected to contain gamma ray emitters. And so if you see them shining in gamma rays, one of the plausible explanation, or the most plausible, but it's some people would say, would be dark matter. The other very good properties of these objects is that you can infer the distribution of the dark matter from the kinematic of the stars. So we don't have the same of the degree of uncertainties for dwarf spheroidals that you have for the galactic center, not knowing how big the profile is. In this case, you can get some distribution on the dark matter content and the dark matter distribution actually looking at the data itself. And it actually turns out that if you, since these sources are either point-like or have very small extension, the detail of the distribution of the dark matter, whether it is a cuspy profile or a cored profile, it doesn't really make a big difference in how much you would expect them to emit in gamma rays anyways. So these are where the dwarf spheroidals that have been considered in this analysis are in the sky. And they basically have been discovered by optical surveys. And there might be more dwarf spheroidals just in part of the sky that haven't been covered by these surveys. So in this analysis, Fermi searched for a signal in gamma rays coming from the direction of these objects. None of these objects was found to have significant emission individually, but also a combined analysis or a combined likelihood analysis that put together all these objects together to see if all together they actually gave a significant signal, again, resulted in no significant detection. So then again, you have no detection, so you can set the constraints on the annihilation cross-section as a function of the mass of the dark matter particles. And again, you always have to make an assumption on the annihilation spectrum. And these limits here for this combined analysis are shown for a BB bar spectrum. And this is the thermal relic, so the cross-section that you expect for a thermal relic, which has a slight dependence on the mass. So that is why this line is actually not straight the way it was shown in other plots. So these are the constraints that we get. And these are the constraints that I've shown before from the Hess galactic center analysis that are shown by the red dashed line. And these contours in the middle show the annihilation cross-section and mass of the dark matter particles that would explain the galactic center in terms of dark matter. So if you look at this figure, it looks like really the dwarf spheroidals are ruling out the dark matter interpretation of the galactic center. However, things are not that simple. So this is roughly the region that this analysis, galactic center analysis, covered. However, these contours do not reflect the uncertainties in the dark matter profiles. And these different analyses are making different assumptions on the cuspiness of the dark matter profile, or say things that would affect the signal, like the local density of dark matter. So if you consider that, that would stretch out this region a little bit. But then if you also include the uncertainties in the background model, so now it's go back to the spectrum that I've shown you, if you use, you have the power law with exponential cutoff, and depending on the assumption you make of the background, you can have a larger cutoff that would give you the spectrum that would give you this dark matter mass. You would also have to stretch this region to higher masses. So what I think it's fair to conclude now is that dwarf spheroidals are beginning to limit to constraints a dark matter explanation of the galactic center, but they are not completely ruling it out. Just wanted to say a little bit more about other optical surveys that are looking for dwarf spheroidal galaxies. The dwarfs that were used for that analysis that I've just shown you were mainly found by the Sloan Digital Sky Surveys, and the gray regions on this map are showing the region that Sloan covered. The DES, the Dark Energy Survey Experiment, has started taking data relatively recently, and these red lines show the part of the sky the DES is going to observe, and it has observed some of that already. And they have recently discovered 8 more objects that are shown by the red points here that appear to be consistent with being dwarf spheroidal galaxies. And that it's so what DS does is just purely photometry. So what DS finds in these points is a high concentration of stars. So a high concentration of stars doesn't really give you information on the total mass of those objects. So a high concentration of stars could be a dwarf spheroidal galaxy, but it also could be a globular clusters. But the reason why people believe that these are actually a dwarf spheroidal galaxy is that if you make a plot that has the absolute luminosity of this object as a function of the size or how extended that high density of stars is, this is the region that is populated by globular clusters, and this is the region that is populated by dwarf spheroidals and satellite galaxies. So they fill different regions, and basically what this is telling you is the dwarf spheroidals are covering larger regions, but they're still bound, they have a larger extension, but they are still bound to each other, those stars, because of a large amount of dark matter that is keeping that object together. There is some indication that these objects that have been recently discovered are dwarf spheroidals based on this type of reasoning. But the only way that you can verify that they actually are systems that contain dark matter is to do spectroscopy. Again, going back to measuring the kinematic of the stars. And so before we can really resolve whether they're dwarf spheroidals or not, we have to get some spectroscopy. And there are plans to do that for these objects. But since people are curious anyways, they have, by knowing the location of these new DES dwarfs, they have looked at the Fermi data to see if there is any excess emission in gamma rays that is coming from there. And that the answer of whether or not there is an excess emission depends on who you ask. The collaboration, Fermi collaboration, doesn't find any excess emission and has set the constraints on the annihilation cross-section by adding these additional objects, hoping that they will be confirmed as dwarfs. But another group that has looked at the gamma ray data actually has found an excess emission between 2 and 10 GeV at the level of 2 to 3.7 sigma, depending on how they model that background. So it is still something that is not a smoking gun signal, but it's not well. In any case, I think that it is important that first we can confirm that these objects are actually dwarf spheroidals. Okay, so ground-based experiment also have observed dwarf spheroidals. I mentioned HASS for the galactic center, but HASS, since it's limited to the view of the southern sky, can't view the most promising dwarf spheroidals, but those are accessible to Veritas and MAGIC, and in particular, these are the Veritas and MAGIC have look in particular at the dwarf spheroidal Segue 1, that is one of the most promising dwarf spheroidal because of its dark matter content and proximity to the sun. They have found no excess emission, and MAGIC is able to determine the strongest constraints. And MAGIC's constraints from the non-detection of Segue 1 are shown by the yellow line here. So the dwarf spheroidal don't give you, it is not surprisingly, the same sensitivity that the galactic center gives you, at least in very high energy gamma rays. So let me skip this. So this is, now this is a plot again that comes from the Fermilat analysis of the 25 confirmed dwarf spheroidals, the limit are shown by the blue line. The dashed red lines are the limits that HASS gets from the galactic center analysis. So this is basically where we are now in constraining the annihilation cross-section for dark matter is the mass of the WIMP spectrum. So you see that the Fermilat space-based experiment gives you the best sensitivity up to dark matter masses of 1 TeV or so, but then it starts losing sensitivity at those high masses, and that's where a ground-based detector that have access to the higher energy gamma rays can pick up. So where do we see things going in the next 5 to 10 years? This is where we believe we could be. So the way the LAT limits have been rescaled is to assume, well, doubling the statistics and assuming that as you cover the entire sky with optical surveys, you're covering three times the sky, you're going to find three times more of the sky, you're going to find three times more dwarfs. And that is just basically rescaling these limits by a factor of 30, okay? Or square root of 30, yes.
What's happening on the left of that plot? Like, why does the line just cut off? Like,
Okay, so here at about 10 GeV?
Yeah.
Right, so that is, if I'm looking for the gamma ray emission coming from a WIMP that has a mass of 10 GeV, the peak of the gamma ray spectrums peaks a much lower energy, right? The 10 GeV is the cutoff. So for the gamma ray spectrum coming from a dark matter mass of 10 GeV, a lot of the gamma rays that would contribute to the signal are outside of the range of the detector. So you're basically missing a lot of the signal, okay? And the improvements in the ground-based experiment would come from CTA, which is an array on the ground of detectors that should be seeing first light in a few years. Okay, so this is all. Oh, okay, I was forgetting this. This is roughly the region that the galactic center gamma ray axis, or galactic dark matter interpretation that the galactic center axis covers, and so you see that it will be. If we can really triple the number of dwarfs, it will be within the reach of the dwarf spheroidals to confirm it, hopefully, or to just rule it out. So you can also look for spectral lines in gamma rays, and I'm going to skip this, but the bottom line is that you can look for this spectral gamma ray line in a detector like Fermi or higher energies also with the ground-based experiment. And there was a claim a couple of years ago that there was a significant line in the Fermi data, but over time that has been resolved as possibly an issue with the detector combined with a statistical fluctuation. So I'm not going to cover that search unless there are questions. I don't know how much longer I have.
Right now it's about 5, so you can take more time.
Okay, I can maybe another 15 minutes or something like that, 10, 15 minutes. Okay, so the other thing that I want to cover as a search is for dark matter, we're now looking at charged particles in cosmic rays. And these are the experiment that I'm going to cover. So Fermi, we have already seen. So the cosmic ray experiments are divided in two broad categories. You have magnetic spectrometers. So these are detectors that have a magnet and have also time of flight instruments in some cases. And because of the magnet that can bend the trajectory of the charge, you can get charge discrimination, and also you can get also some information about the charge ID. So these are the magnetic spectrometers that I'm going to talk about. This is the PAMELA experiment. This is AMS, and then there is another class of cosmic ray experiments to which Fermilab belong that doesn't have a magnet. It basically does calorimetry. However, Fermi can use, so it doesn't have any charge discrimination capability, but you can use the magnetic field of the Earth to actually discriminate the positively charged from negatively charged particles because of the east-west effect. Basically, because the magnetic field will bend particle of different charge in different direction, you can narrow down some part of the sky that is mainly populated by positrons or mainly populated by electrons. In that case, you actually can measure things like the positron fraction, even with an experiment like Fermi that doesn't have a magnet on board. Another difference is that, say, you have an experiment like Fermi. Fermi has a large field of view, right? It's an experiment that is like a squashed cube, so it's pretty wide. But you see that these magnetic spectrometers are long. You have limitation due to the magnet, so they can see a smaller fraction of the sky. So they have a limited field of view. Okay, so what do these experiments measure? Let's look at the electrons and positrons first. So this is the measurement of the positron fraction, so the ratio between the positrons in cosmic rays and the electrons as a function of the energy. The red points here is the measurement by AMS. The blue points are the measurement by PAMELA. And these green points are the measurement that Fermi performs by using the Earth's magnetic field and the east-west effect. So there are some discrepancies. So Fermi seems to have a problem with the normalization, and PAMELA and AMS don't agree at low energy, but anything that happens below 10 GeV or so is going to depend on solar modulation, and solar modulation depends on the solar cycle. So there is going to be a dependence on when those observations were made. And generally when they disagree is because they correspond to different observation times that can be tracked back to the solar cycle. So if you then above 10 GeV or so, the positron fraction rises. And AMS has measured this positron fraction up to 500 GeV. So the fact that the positron fraction rises was seen as it was initially unexpected when PAMELA first found it, because it diverged very abruptly from the prediction that the people had pre-PAMELA from the positron fraction that you would measure if positrons are only created by primary cosmic rays interacting with the interstellar medium, and you would expect that fraction to go down as a function of the energy if that's the only way that you can produce them. But Pamela observed something, a behavior, and then later confirmed by Fermi and AMS that that fraction was increasing. So, but if the fraction is increasing, that might be that the actual spectrum of the positrons is going to rising. Or sorry, it's becoming less steep compared to what it was predicted to be. Or it might actually be that the spectrum of the electrons is becoming softer, and that this also going to make the positron fraction rise. What you can do with experiments like AMS and also Pamela, but these results are from AMS, is to measure the positrons and the electron spectrum separately. And you can see that the electron spectrum is not getting softer. It is the positron spectrum that is actually is becoming harder. And then if you look at the spectra also, there is no single power law that describes either spectra. And this plot here shows the spectrum of the combined electrons plus positron emission. The blue points are always AMS. And in this case, Pamela Fermi, I don't think Pamela is shown here, but they are in good agreement. And actually, the combined spectrum of electrons and positrons above about 30 GeV is actually consistent with a power law. Over an energy range up to roughly 1 TeV, then where you start seeing a cutoff that is measured by Hess. So the rise in the positron fraction spurred a big number of articles on the fact that it could be interpreted as a signal of dark matter annihilation. And this is an example of those studies. If you assume annihilation into taus, and then you get electrons and positrons from the tau decays, for a 1 TeV, because the mass, right now that we have the positron fraction measure up to 500 GeV, and above 250 GeV or so, it looks like the spectrum is starting to turn over, but we quite haven't seen the cutoff. The mass of the dark matter particle has to be definitely higher than 500 GeV. And so this is what you get as the spectrum of a 1 TeV particle that is annihilating into tau. And it describes the data pretty well. And this is the expectation for the prediction for the background, again, only assuming secondary production of cosmic rays and standard propagation. However, if you want to explain the this excess in the rise in the positron fraction in dark matter, you'll also expect to see a signal in other wavelength. And this is for, again, annihilation into taus. You have inverse Compton emission from the leptons that come out of that interaction from the decays of the taus that are going to generate inverse Compton emission, as well as a contribution from final state radiation. But there is not such an excess observed in gamma rays, and that can constrain a dark matter interpretation of the Pamela positron, or of the positron rise. And the point is that to explain such a big rise, the annihilation cross section has to be pretty big, 10 to the minus 23 centimeter square per second. So, and actually, you have other constraints in addition to gamma rays. Actually, you can constrain the dark matter interpretation of the positron rise by also using CMB, because such large cross section are going to reheat and ionize in the early universe, and then they would affect the power spectrum. So you can also set constraints in that way. But you can also explain the rise of the positron fraction by just conventional processes. You can assume that there is a nearby source, such as a pulsar or a supernova remnant. So if this is the secondary cosmic ray positron emission, and then you add a nearby source that is accelerating electrons, you'll be able to see electrons coming from the source to such high energies, and you can get a good fit to the data in this way. You can actually reproduce the data fairly well. And if this is caused by a relatively nearby source, you can actually look for an anisotropy in the distribution of the positrons. But we haven't observed an anisotropy, but the level at which you can rule out that there is anisotropy is not completely ruling out that there is, in fact, a relatively nearby source that is producing these events. And so this is just the explanation of the positron fraction with one additional nearby source that accelerates electrons and positrons. And this is the same spectrum now. This is a positron fraction, and this is just the spectrum of the positrons multiplied by E cube. And you can, instead of just assuming one nearby source, so you can assume that there is a whole population of relatively nearby sources that are accelerating positrons, and that's the blue band on this plot. So there are conventional ways that you can use to explain this. But there is also, nearby sources, but you can also explain it, or at least some people have proposed, with the secondary positron production. So one argument goes as follows. You can set a limit or an upper bound on the positron fraction just using the boron to carbon ratio. As we discussed yesterday, the boron, which is a secondary nucleus to carbon ratio, constrains the grammage in the galaxy, so it constrains the production of secondary cosmic rays for boron as well as for positrons. So the positrons will actually lose energy fast after they produce because they radiate. So the largest number that you'd expect to have in the positron fraction from secondary emission can be set conservatively just by measuring the boron to carbon ratio, and that's the line that you see on this plot, and this is the positron fraction observed by AMS. And so the argument is that the positron, the reason the positron fraction is not violating this upper bound, and therefore you can't rule out the secondary production of positrons. So there is another argument that says, yes, you can have secondary production of positrons, but additional secondary production of positrons, but not in the interstellar space, but rather at the sources that are accelerating the cosmic rays. So you're at a supernova remnant. The supernova remnant is accelerating proton. The proton is interacting with the medium at the supernova remnant before it escapes the source. And so it might produce a positron there. And since the spectrum of the proton spectrum at the source, it's harder than the spectrum of the protons after they have diffused to the galaxy, you would actually expect those positrons to have a harder spectrum that you would predict from positrons that have been produced as secondary in the interstellar space. However, these acceleration processes happen in a relatively short amount of time, so people didn't expect to see that kind of process to generate such an excess. But the fact that the spectrum is harder might be actually opens up the possibility that you can actually explain it, the rise in the positron fraction in this way. But then if you say that you can produce secondaries relatively well at the source, that particular argument would also apply to other secondary nuclei, like, for instance, boron. And so you actually also expect to have a rise in the boron to carbon ratio, which we don't observe. Okay, so that was where we are for the measurement of the positron fraction and its possible interpretations. What about antiprotons? So I'm focusing on the antiparticle component of cosmic rays, because those are the best targets when you're looking for a dark matter annihilation signal, because they are not produced as in a very, very large abundances in cosmic rays. So your background is smaller, as if you were to look for a signal of dark matter just looking at electrons or looking at protons. So let's look at antiprotons now. So these are mainly measurements by AMS. So these are some measurements now of the antiproton to proton fraction by AMS, and they have extended the measurement of this ratio up to 450 GeV. And it actually appears that the antiproton fraction is in very good agreement with the secondary production of antiprotons, so antiprotons being produced in the interstellar space. And these are some fit by making some a standard assumption on cosmic ray propagation. So there is nothing exciting. There is no exciting excess there. You can also use this kind of study to constrain the contribution that comes from secondary production in this measurement in the antiproton data, and use what is left over to constrain a dark matter contribution. And these are the limits that you get on the annihilation cross section. This is again for annihilation into bottom quark. But again, these kind of limits are very much dependent on how you are modeling the cosmic rays. Okay, so I think it's probably time to conclude. I had a bunch of slides on neutrinos, and I'll be happy to cover them in case people have questions. So these are my conclusion. So far, we've had over time a number of hints of possible dark matter signals. Some have come and gone. Some have persisted, like, for instance, the positron fraction. But in that case, there are other possible explanations for the observations. In the case of the galactic center axis observed in gamma rays with Fermi, has been around for about 5 years at this point. However, there are still a lot of complications in modeling the background in that case, that more work needs really is required. And best case scenario, there might be a detection coming from another experiment or a different search in gamma rays that might confirm it. Because if that doesn't happen, it's just going to be very hard to accept it at face value. So there are improvements. So in addition to these possible hints of dark matter, indirect dark matter detection continue to set strong constraints. And that's all. And there is one thing that I really didn't cover at all, and it is complementarity between direct detection and collider searches, which is really also very, very important. Okay, that's all. Thank you. Yes.
On neutrino limits at all competitive with the gamma ray limits?
Yeah, so neutrinos don't provide very strong constraints for indirect detection. And so that is just really determined by the amount of neutrinos that you get out of dark matter annihilation. And also because of the energies that an experiment like, say, IceCube is sensitive to, their constraints are strongest at higher masses. So these are constraints. So you can do a number of things with neutrinos. You can look at the galactic center, and these are the constraints that you get with IceCube, depending on the annihilation final state. And then if you compare those with Fermi, Fermi gives you the purple line, so they're quite a bit stronger. And this is for the search, not at the galactic center, but looking for anisotropy in the sky. Where actually IceCube does well is in constraining the scattering cross-section between dark matter and nucleons. So basically, you're looking for WIMPs that get trapped in the sun. And so they're captured in the sun. They accumulate there because, right, they are scattering with the nucleons in the sun. And they eventually annihilate. And so you might see a signal in neutrino. So if you assume equilibrium between capture and annihilation, you can get information on the scattering cross-section between dark matter and essentially protons in the sun. And IceCube is particularly good at setting constraints on spin-dependent interaction. And the limits that IceCube sets on spin-dependent interaction are shown here. Depending here, there is a dependence on the annihilation channel, whether it goes into BB bar or say it goes into W. So, and so the limits can change quite a bit, but they are very competitive when you compare to them to direct detection experiments on the ground that are sensitive to spin-dependent interaction. So you get very strong constraint on spin-dependent interaction because mainly that is what you're probing in the sun, right? The cross-section depends on the spin of the dark matter. It really scales as the dot product of the spin of the dark matter and the spin of the nucleon. And so it's important for odd number nuclei, and the sun is mainly made out of protons, so you can get very strong limits. However, if you look at the constraints for spin-dependent interactions, if you look at experiments on, well, these are upcoming experiments on the ground, like xenon or LAX, they can do a lot better. And so this is IceCube, where IceCube current constraints are, and these are other ground-based direct detection experiments. So at high energy still does relatively well until these experiments on the grounds are going to come online.
In addition to the dwarf...
These are current results. Sorry, they're not upcoming. Yes.
In addition to the dwarf spherulines, what other extragalactic objects can be traced as
galaxies? Clusters of galaxies. Clusters of galaxies have a lot more dark matter than dwarf spheroidals, but they're much farther away. So what people calculate is the J factor, which is the integral over the line of sight of the dark matter density. So for overall, it turns out that for a galaxy cluster, this J factor is smaller, because even though you have a larger dark matter density, you have to take in the distance into account, and that is much, much farther. And so overall, the J factor for galaxy clusters is smaller. They're not as promising as dwarf spheroidals. But people have looked for an excess. And also the things with galaxy clusters is that if you actually observe them in gamma rays, it can be interaction with the cosmic rays in the clusters with the gas. And so then you'll have to find a way to discriminate the spectra or the flux that you're observing for the cosmic ray interpretation or a dark matter interpretation. So that's one of the things. Or you can also be bold and look at the emission in gamma rays coming for all dark matter substructures at all redshifts. But then you have to have information on how dark matter has evolved over such long timescales. And the uncertainties on the signal are very, very large. But people are still also looking for that sort of thing. Yes. But really, the ones that I've shown, like dwarf spheroidals, are really the most powerful we have, the most powerful targets we have so far.
I think you said that, actually, when you talked about the nearby sources, you know, non-dark matter explanations for the panel access, you said,
yes.
How nearby were you talking about there? Because one example you gave was Dominga, which is so close you can actually see proper motion.
Yes.
Do
yes.
Close,
actually, I think in the yes. I mean that in this plot. Yes, Geminga is the prediction that you have. Yes, I mean as you go to higher energy, you start because the positrons, actually the positrons lose energy very fast.
Yeah.
So that's really as close as they can be. Otherwise, you wouldn't be detecting if they were farther away. You wouldn't be detecting positrons to such high energies. That is really the reason to have them nearby, because you have to get positrons to you from that source at these energies.
And that close, that it's not like they're expecting there to be an unknown population here. You're looking at known things.
Right. For I mean, the thing is that if you right, this is a population, actually, this was the other plot that I had. This is a population. This is actually for pulsar wind nebulae. And then, right, this is the combined contribution from a lot of objects. And so you can have them at different distances. So if the source is a little farther away, if you only have one, you might not get any events. If you have a population of them, right, you're increasing the statistics a little bit, but they still have to be relatively nearby. I don't remember the distances that you have for the population and how right broad this distribution is to give you this kind of signal. But these objects has actually been picked out from an existing catalog, so they do actually exist. It's not just simulations or just hand waving. They actually looked at objects that have been observed at other wavelength. And they have a lot of information on those objects, and they claim they are consistent with the Rayleigh positron. Yeah.
All right, that's probably a good place to close off. I wish to thank you one more time. This is the last.
Yes.